Since it was founded, the conservation movement has focused on protecting and preserving our natural places. But according to Joe Whitworth, president of the Freshwater Trust, that is no longer enough. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Whitworth about his work restoring freshwater ecosystems in Oregon, how he believes that clean water can coexist with profitable agriculture, and the future of conservation. Later in the hour, many of the pharmaceuticals we use wind up in our water. We'll talk about a recent study from the University of Iowa that found that certain steroids may persist in our water supply longer than we used to think they did. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll take a fresh look at water quality in Iowa and around the country. Later in the hour, we'll talk about some pharmaceutical compounds that may cause some long-term problems by sticking around in our water supply. But first, Joe Whitworth is with me. He's the president of the Freshwater Trust in Portland, Oregon. He'll be in Iowa next Wednesday as the keynote speaker at the Iowa Environmental Council's annual conference in Des Moines. Hello, Joe.
Morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And I know that you live in Oregon now, but I've been told that when you were growing up, you used to spend your summers in Iowa.
Well, you know, I spent my summers just south of the Iowa line, just in north central Missouri. And so for a big time after we would end up bucking hay, we would travel to Centerville, Iowa, and have dinner. That was the big thing to do.
All right. Well, in a recent TED Talk that you gave about water quality, you talked about an image that many of us have seen, some of us live on television, some of us only in later years, that image of the Cuyahoga River, one of the most polluted rivers in the United States at one time, on fire in 1969. And a lot of us like to believe that that kind of water pollution is really in our past. But you argue that, in a way, our rivers are still on fire. What do you see as the challenges facing our rivers today?
Well, that picture was taken of the Cuyahoga River when I was about 6 months old. And today I'm 44. And, you know, the world has changed in a lot of ways. Of course, we don't see the big chemical fires on our waters that we did back in the late 60s. But we, of course, have a lot of problems with our waters, and they're a lot more subtle than they used to be. One that hits close to home in the Middle West, where I grew up and where you're sitting now, is, of course, related to runoff, primarily through agriculture. That leads to a dead zone each year in the Gulf of Mexico. And what's difficult about that is it comes from a million different little places as opposed to those very easily findable pipes that were first regulated under the Clean Water Act. And right now, we have of the United States' 3.5 million stream miles, more than 55% of those stream miles are impaired, meaning they don't function properly. And so despite four decades of focused environmental effort and a lot of conservation and restoration actions, we're still a long way from having healthy water in this country.
When you say that those stream miles are impaired, that they're not functioning properly, what does that mean?
Well, rivers need several things, and essentially, they need to act like rivers, and that has been somewhat inconvenient for us here, humans, who want to really adjust how a river works in the name of planting crops or growing cities or just making roads so we can transport here and there. And so, under the Clean Water Act, our waterways are supposed to be fishable, swimmable, and drinkable. And those all have really clear definitions around waters have to be a certain temperature in order to support the aquatic life that lives under the surface, but also really be able to properly synthesize the extra inputs that we as humans provide them. So, you know, for example, the dead zone, the reason that that exists is that we overload the waterways with whether they're pesticides, fertilizers, and so forth that can't be broken down properly. So temperature, the cooler the temperature, the greater the oxygen content, and oxygen is what's needed to break down those fertilizers. There is some capacity within all rivers to break those down at a certain level, but if they become inundated, they really can't function properly. So it has a lot to do with how well the river and its structure and the inputs are working together.
Now, something else that I've heard you talk about is the fact that you feel that the conservation movement isn't doing enough. It's not enough now to protect our natural places and try to prevent pollution from entering our streams and rivers. You feel that the conservation movement needs to take a move forward. What do you think that move needs to be?
Well, I think we have to be pretty honest with where we are right now in the world. The world has changed, and a lot of the things that we once took as true or as gospel no longer applies as it once did. And, you know, with regard to the environmental community, remember when we set up in the 1970s as against an economy that had overreached and rendered things like burning rivers, our core competency became the Great Green Wall of No. And what we did was we made sure that to put in safeguards to keep bad things from happening. But today, those safeguards have become, they've started to keep good things from happening. And for example, you know, we fix rivers at the Freshwater Trust. And, you know, so we get out there with our Tonka trucks and we'll move dirt and take straightened rivers and put them back in, put back their historic curves. And given the procedural steps and rules that are in place right now, it takes us almost 3 years in permitting and funding cycles in order to get the chance to do sometimes only a single week of work, because we have to go through the same hurdles to fix a stream as someone who wants to strip gravel from a stream. And that's not really what was intended, I don't think, a long time ago. And so what we have to relearn as a conservation community is we can be right on the law and completely wrong in the water. And just litigating and winning suits doesn't always translate into benefits to the very ecosystems we are intending to help.
Can you give me a specific example of an area where you've seen that approach fail?
Well, I think our 1.6 million stream miles in the United States after four decades of focused environmental litigation would be example A. I think that what we're starting to see, and we've seen it in our region, we've also seen it in other regions, where we can win a procedural lawsuit, one that's very typical that we learn in the second year of law school is there are certain sets of steps that must be taken under the National Environmental Protection Act, NEPA, or the Clean Water Act, or the ESA, if you have an endangered species involved in an area where, or in an action, that must be undertaken. So you have to consult with another agency. And a lot of times that consulting either gets done poorly or doesn't get completed, and so you can begin to stop those actions. And even though we're seeing those are pretty easy lawsuits to win, but even when we win, what you win is something that looks like another decade or two of consulting, which holds up all of your restoration actions and holds up several things that would be helping the environment going forward. And so that's the kind of thing that we need to avoid and say, let's start with the outcome in mind instead of the procedural miscue that needs to be corrected. And I think that what we're finding is the agencies that once they lose a lawsuit, they really don't have the capacity or the funding to get the consulting and the scientific analysis done on a time frame that really is going to matter. And then after that, they have a really hard time enforcing the laws and the rules on the books, as well as just going out and getting the funding together to try and make positive action happening. And so what we're finding is this effort within the conservation community, I put us at the top of the list. You know, we listed several of the first salmon species under the Endangered Species Act out here. But what we realized is right now we have 28 species on the list, which is what we helped put on there. And those 28 species are not going to be coming off anytime soon for any dollar figure or any timeline. And so what we have to do is think, is the point getting them on the list and keeping those species on the list, or is the point to engage in enough actions so that they can recover and we can get them off the list? And that's really the fundamental change that our organization has gone through over the last decade, and really one that environmentalism has to take a hard look at if we want to remain relevant for this coming century.
Well, it doesn't sound like an either-or kind of situation. It sounds like these things have to go hand in hand.
Oh, you're 1,000,000% right. And I think that right now we're just trying to figure out what that balance looks like, because we have as a movement just decades of muscle memory, so that if we see a problem, we have to hit it with a lawsuit. And what we want to do is, or what we really need to do is, honestly, we need to take a time out. You know, and it may be a one-year truce or something along those lines, or ceasefire, and see if we can't get together and have an honest discussion about, is this really getting the job done? Are the tools that we're using really going to be the tools that we need to use forever, or do we need to add to that toolkit?
Well, we are going to take a quick time out right here. We'll be gone for just a couple of minutes. We'll be back to talk more about new ways to tackle water quality problems in the United States, in Oregon, and in Iowa. My guest right now is Joe Whitworth. He's the president of the Freshwater Trust in Portland, Oregon. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about water. And coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk about some pharmaceutical compounds that may be sticking around in our water a little longer than we originally thought. That's coming up in a few minutes. Right now, I'm talking with Joe Whitworth. He's the president of the Freshwater Trust based in Portland, Oregon. He'll be in Iowa next Wednesday as the keynote speaker at the Iowa Environmental Council's annual conference in Des Moines. That's coming up on the 11th. And Joe, before the break, we were talking about the new approach that you think we need to have to conservation in this country: less litigation, more action. Let's talk about putting these ideas into action, because I know that you've been working hard to do that in Oregon. Can you give me an example of a freshwater ecosystem that you have been working in that you feel that you've really been able to make progress at restoration?
Yeah, we've been working here in the Rogue River system pretty directly, and the Rogue River was one of the first wild and scenic rivers designated in 1968. It's a big salmon river out here, and has a few species listed under the Endangered Species Act, so it's a pretty critical river. It has several issues, not unlike what we've seen or what we see not just in Iowa but all around the country with issues around temperature and sediments and so forth. The city of Medford was looking at building a cooling tower. And the reason they were building a cooling tower is under the Clean Water Act, temperature is a pollutant because it impacts the aquatic species under the surface. And if you have a pipe that has an impact on a waterway that is limited by temperature, you have to operate under a permit or to the specifications of a permit. And so there are 12,000 of these permits in this region and about 200,000 of them across the country. And those permits are administered by EPA or their state corollaries. And so the city of Medford was looking at building a cooling tower to deal with their temperature problems or their temperature impacts. And it was going to cost them $20 to $25 million, and what we have done here, really just by trying to solve the problem in our hand, there was no grand plan to get into this business 10 years ago, but essentially there are accounting standards that can quantify specifically the restoration actions into temperature uplift, and so rather than just having a single option of, hey, we have to go build this expensive capital project cooling tower, we can actually go out and do restoration upstream in a quantified way that more than offsets their temperature impacts. In fact, the trading ratios, if you will, here in Oregon are 2-to-1. So if you have a single unit of impact, you have to offset it with 2 units of quantified restoration. And so what we were able to do was go in and work with the city and set up the program where we can do a 2-to-1 offset of their impacts. And by doing it, we not only, instead of spending $20 million, they're going to spend about $8 million. Which saves the ratepayers money. We're going to go upstream and do restoration, which generates actually a lot of local jobs, a lot of business around nurseries. I mean, we're buying 600,000 native plants that we will be planting in buffer strips near the streams to provide shade over time. We also pay for the folks to do the restoration. We compensate the landowners to grow bushels of nature. And the river wins. So it's kind of an interesting take on rather than trying to, I mean, we have to play within rules, and certainly the rules are the foundation of this entire, the integrity of this system. But within that, we were able to make huge environmental gains while also, you know, making it work financially for the city, for the ratepayers, and instead of wagging our fingers at those landowners, we said, hey, how do we work together to get good things done on the ground at a scale that matters? And I think that it's the scale and the speed of things within this type of a model that can really make a difference.
So in this case, just to recap, you're talking about planting trees and other native plants along the river using money that would have been put into building a giant machinery that would have maybe had the same temperature impact.
I think that's, you journalists are so much more succinct, but that's exactly right. You know, it's really important that we do focus the resources that we are putting at this issue a little more smartly than we have been in the past. I mean, wastewater facilities and industry are always looking for ways to save money that they can pass on to the ratepayers or their customers, and you know, the other agencies. I mean, we spend billions of dollars literally in this country each year, and it's not exactly clear what benefit we're getting. And so the rigor involved with these mechanics for a water quality trade, we can realize that not all restoration is created equal. And we should invest our dollars, whether they are the billions of dollars that we spend each year publicly or the millions of dollars that we spend each year in philanthropy or privately, to get the greatest amount of uplift that we possibly can so that we can, again, make a difference on a timeline and a scale that matter.
Well, you've certainly come up with a win-win situation in that scenario for business, for the city, for the river as well. But we're in this case, we're talking about point pollution, where there is a specific place where we know that the water temperature is rising, and that's the problem that you have to deal with. Of course, in Iowa, we have a lot of non-point pollution, and it's not as simple as making a water quality trade with a business or with an organization or even a city. Do you have ideas for how to approach some of the problems that we have using the same kind of system?
Well, yeah, the big innovation with our work is that it does work point source to non-point source. I mean, the temperature, the biggest inputs in temperature in any river system in the world is the sun. And so that is a non-point source input. The sun that is allowed into a river that has been, you know, its banks and its adjacent fields have been simplified to allow for cropping, right? And so we have done what is essentially the same thing that you need to do in Iowa and the other Midwestern states to deal with non-point source issues, in that you have we are in this instance, in the first instance of these deals, we've been solving for temperature. But when you're solving for nutrients, the accounting focus simply shifts from kilocalories of solar energy, as we have out here, to pounds of nitrogen or phosphorus. But the mechanics remain the same. As it turns out, you know, even in Iowa, right now, the nutrient strategy that Iowa State put out recently points to almost $1.5 billion in expenditures on nutrient-focused technology over the next 20 years. And if you could take some of those dollars and intelligently apply those to areas that are having the greatest nutrient inputs, you could probably see a bigger uptake in water quality benefit for a far smaller cost than what industry and wastewater facilities are going to have to be dealing with over the next couple of decades.
But and we have done a program recently about the recommendations that came out not long ago. And for farmers, who of course are a lot of the non-point source polluters in this state, the recommendations are entirely voluntary. What's in it for the farmer? What kind of a trade can we make?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, we've gone through decades of this, the voluntary incentive stuff, and that does good things, don't get me wrong, but it's honestly, it's just not adding up. And it's been a sort of a catch-as-catch-can type of atmosphere, and this is true across all public and private funding that are trying to utilize these incentives. You know, one of the biggest problems architecturally is, you know, under the Clean Water Act, it's very difficult to regulate agriculture. And I don't, you know, I'm not out there wagging my finger at agriculture, but I can't hide my head in the sand and say that they're not the issue with regard to water, because they are. And it's not because they wake up in the morning saying, how can I put the herd on the stream today? They're just trying to get by. We recognize that. But it's got to be more than just incentives. And that's where this is the change. We are working with landowners to do their 20-year contracts. They operate just like a land lease. And it's marginal land. Right now, a lot of the land's getting sloughed off with corn still down into those, corn still on it, down into the river system. And so what we're doing is saying, hey, look, we're going to come in, and along this mile of stream, we're going to compensate you to essentially grow bushels of nature so that we get the type of protections from our waterways that we need. And, you know, it's no secret the way you fix the dead zone is you don't let the excess nutrients into the water. We can have a dead zone-free Gulf of Mexico next year if we all just backed off the stream. But we have to be more realistic. We can't ask farmers just to do this out of, you know, just out of the goodness of their heart. They have implement payments to make. They have kids to send to college, and we've got to find a better way. And in our model, what we do is we flat out compensate farmers to grow bushels of nature on those acres that are most sensitive and critical to achieving freshwater health. So we've taken a step beyond the public granting programs in order to get the outcomes that we need. And technology being what it is today, we can go into a basin and figure out where the biggest inputs for water quality detriment are, and then work with those landowners in a way that makes sense for them financially and us ecologically.
And where does that money come from?
Well, in this is the great genius in our work around water quality trading, and I say that absolutely tongue-in-cheek because it's not that genius. Somebody's got to pay. And in our case, what we have done is we have taken dollars that would have otherwise been spent to build a great big chilling tower that has a huge capital cost, gray infrastructure that you have to operate and maintain for years and years through energy, which has its own negative impacts on the environment. And we've essentially reallocated a subset of those dollars to get better environmental outcomes on the land itself and in the water itself. And that's where, you know, where we are today in history, the point sources are on the hook to deal with these things. Leaving the equity in whether they're the source of the problem or not off, you know, for another day. Right now, what we can do is get action on the ground at a ratepayer cost savings, and then ultimately get the behavioral change on the land and get into the practice of quantifying the uplift, not just sort of doing good things and hoping that someday they will come together. I mean, it is, you know, the theory that, you know, if we just spread these seeds and 1,000 flowers will bloom, it's not played out like that. And we've got to get a lot more focused and intentional about the outcomes we need, whether we are doing it on a voluntary basis or in a regulated and permitted basis. We have to quantify everything that we do with regard to conservation going forward.
Where does this movement need to come from? I mean, obviously your group has been extremely active in Oregon. There are a lot of people in Iowa who are concerned about water quality. There are a lot of farmers in Iowa that are concerned about water quality but also need to make a profit. What groups do you see coming together to make something like this work here?
Well, I mean, look, we're not going to stop. And I think that the thing is it's really hard. What we have done over the last decade is flat. It's just difficult. We challenged ourselves. If we came down, landed on Earth today, and we were in charge, what would we build? And if we could answer that question, we challenged ourselves to go out and build it. And we kept on doing that over and over and over. And it's organizationally, it's very difficult to do, to continue to allocate limited resources to innovate. But we have done it and done it and done it. And, you know, I think, you know, I mentioned that we need something of a ceasefire with the environmental community. And we have such muscle memory around, really, it's deconstructive. How do you stop things? How do you slow things down? And the time for that is, the returns on that are diminishing rapidly. Where we have to go now is, and we have talked to some National Foundation partners about bringing together groups that are not simply the environmental community, but the environmental thought leaders that are willing to change, not just come in and, you know, do it as we always do, line up your bunker and then shoot at the other side for the pieces that you don't like, but environmental thought leaders, agricultural thought leaders, philanthropy, public agencies, and decision makers, and delineate a path forward. What we have is an eminently fixable problem that we cannot get out of our own way to fix right now, because the tools that we have built are the only tools that we have, and we distrust many others. And, you know, it's you know, to the environmental community, I say, look, it's okay to change, and it's okay to need to recalibrate. We need new tools. You know, to the agricultural community, I'd say, look, you know, we don't want to put you out of business. We want to keep you in business. But right now, we're not on track to feed the world and not destroy our underlying resource base to do it every year thereafter. Philanthropy needs to understand that there's a better way to allocate your dollars, and you need to demand quantified uplift from all the actions that you're supporting.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for talking with me today. Joe Whitworth is the president of the Freshwater Trust in Portland, Oregon. He'll be in Iowa next Wednesday as the keynote speaker at the Iowa Environmental Council's annual conference in Des Moines. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Charity.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. We've been talking big picture about some of the challenges facing our waterways this hour. Now let's talk about a specific threat: pharmaceuticals, and even more specifically, steroids. David Swartney is assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Iowa. He's also co-author of a new study led by the University of Iowa and published last week online in the journal Science. Hello, David.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And this new study focused on three specific drugs that are found in our waterways. I want to start with just one of those drugs, an anabolic steroid, and 10-bolone acetate is its name?
Yeah, so in a really productive collaboration with the University of Nevada, Reno, and my colleague, Ed Kolodziej, we've really been looking at trenbolone acetate and its the fate of its metabolites in the environment for about 4 years, and that was really the basis of the current study, just looking at some of the unexpected fate and chemistry that goes on once it might make its way into our waterways as a result of being excreted as a result of manufacture or sort of meat.
Okay, well, yeah, let's talk about this substance because it is a banned substance for human use. It used to be used in bodybuilding, but it is not allowed to be used anymore. What are the legal uses for this drug?
Well, trenbolone acetate is one of six hormones that's approved by the FDA for use as a growth promoter in meat production. And so there are actually three synthetic compounds, trenbolone acetate being one of them. It's a synthetic androgen that's given to beef cattle for the express purpose of increasing feed efficiency and weight gain, essentially making bigger cattle with leaner meat as the end result.
All right. And how is it making its way into our water?
Well, just like any drugs we take, cattle will get an implant of trenbolone acetate. It's actually delivered as an implant to their ear. It works its way through its body. It gets metabolized and excreted in the waste of the animal, so in the urine and the feces of the animal. And then you worry about runoff. And so if you can think of a simple case of a rainfall event that might cause some of the leaching of the compound out of that waste product and into adjacent water bodies. And that's really been the focus of our work, is thinking of these agriculturally impacted systems and what trenbolone might do there.
All right. And you actually pulled water out of the Iowa River, right?
We did some of our experiments in the Iowa River. There was a real push from some of the reviewers that looked at our work internally that wanted to make sure what we were doing wasn't just a laboratory-based study and had real relevance for, I mean, let's face it, the Iowa River is a very complex aquatic body with a lot of sort of constituents that could compete with some of the processes we were seeing. And so we wanted to prove that real-world relevance.
All right. And there had been assumptions about this substance in water and how it would break down. What did we think would happen to it?
Yeah, you know, trenbolone and its metabolites are sort of controversial in some ways because they're known endocrine-disrupting compounds for aquatic organisms. And so fairly low exposures, what we might call trace, can have some pretty profound impacts on the biology of these of certain aquatic organisms. All that being said, it's widely used under the assumption, largely, that it breaks down quickly in the environment. And one of the pathways that has often been pointed to that limits its environmental persistence is its ability to break down in sunlight. That sunlight can provide light energy to really break apart the molecule and turn it into something else that was assumed to be less harmful than the actual parent compound itself.
All right. And in real-world studies, you found that our assumptions were not accurate. What did you find?
Yeah, one of our real focus has always been just trying to chase the transformation products. And so what we found was, you know, in our early work, indeed, trenbolone does degrade really quickly in sunlight. And you might just stop there. I mean, I think we're ingrained as scientists that if we're interested in following the persistence of a pollutant in the environment, if we see it go away, we assume everything's okay. But we took it one step further, and what we found was that the products of some of the of this particular reaction with sunlight in and of themselves were unstable, and that in at nighttime, those products broke down and ultimately regenerated the parent trenbolone compound, proving that it has much greater persistence in the environment than we currently believe as a result of this essentially reversible transformation pathway.
Okay, reversible transformation pathway. Explain that to me.
Yeah, well, so again, we were talking about the ability of sunlight to break down the compound, to break down trenbolone. And really what we found is that sunlight breaks it down, but that at night, that reaction essentially runs in reverse, and the product of that reaction with sunlight goes the opposite direction and ends up regenerating trenbolone to levels that we think could have a profound impact on aquatic ecosystems.
Well, and let's talk about some of the effects that it might have on aquatic ecosystems. I mean, having these pharmaceuticals in the water, of course, fish are ingesting them. There are other animals, other creatures in these ecosystems that would also be ingesting them as well. What do we think the effects might be?
Yeah, now I should be, you know, we didn't really do any ecotoxicity studies ourselves, but we I think we would argue that the ecotoxic effects of trenbolone and its metabolites are pretty well known. There's been some really great work out of Gary Ankley's lab, who's been affiliated with the US EPA, that has shown that, you know, at really low levels, and so 10 nanograms per liter is really quite small when we think about concentrations that might be present in the environment, you can see reduction in the ability of fish to reproduce, and so we see reductions in fecundity. And then there's reports that even at, say, like 16 nanograms per liter, which, again, the average person would just see is or hear as trace, you can occasionally see complete sex reversal in some aquatic organisms. A lot of those studies have been done with a particular, I think, a fathead minnow, which is a good indicator organism that can be sensitive to these types of endocrine-disrupting compounds.
So you're saying this minnow could be a male and become a female or vice
versa?
It's
actually the other way around.
Okay, the other
way. Trenbolone's an androgen. It's essentially an analog of testosterone that we produce as humans. It's just a much more potent analog. And so what people have reported is masculinization of female fish, and that you can see female fish developing male characteristics. And you can imagine how if the gender of a population begins to skew, there will be challenges for that population to continue to be healthy and thrive and reproduce.
Right. If there are not enough females to lay eggs, then there are not going to be a lot of offspring.
Absolutely.
You didn't just look at this one drug. You also looked at two other drugs as well. Can you tell me a little bit about those drugs?
Yeah, probably the one that's most important is it's known as Dienagest. It's actually used as an oral contraceptive in a prescription product. So it's used for birth control by humans. This is a human pharmaceutical. And we felt it was important to not just limit our focus to trenbolone, but maybe take what we learned from trenbolone and try to figure out if other chemicals that we might come in contact with could do the same thing. And sure enough, we see that this compound Dienagest, which is, again, it's a progestin that sort of influences the birthing cycle of females. When it's exposed to sunlight, it behaves very much, you know, analogously to what the sort of dynamic and diurnal cycling we see for trenbolone. And it's important that this isn't now just limited to an agricultural water concern, but might be an urban ecosystem concern for the organisms that might come into contact with those types of compounds as well.
All right, and I can imagine that if birth control substances get into the water, that they may also act as birth control substances for aquatic organisms, right?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, these chemicals are designed with a specific structure that allows them to interact with the endocrine system in organisms. We often teach it as a lock and key mechanism, that it's a very specific interaction in which a chemical might bind to a receptor in an organism's body. These chemicals were designed to have this impact, and I think this is they're what Ed and I have occasionally called sort of high-risk emerging contaminants that we're still, as a community, trying to figure out the real risks associated with them. We think we're fairly convinced there's an ecosystem risk, but we need to really focus, I think, on these ones that are really designed to be highly bioactive and potent.
Well, and of course, you chose three drugs to focus on, but there are so many drugs that are being prescribed and used and passed through our systems every day. How did you even choose these three drugs to focus on?
Yeah, that's a great question at several levels. I mean, as to why we chose trenbolone, about 4 years ago, the U.S. Department of Agriculture had a call for proposals, and we were looking to get to do some research in this area of emerging contaminants that are relevant for agriculture. And I think, much to Ed and I's surprise, there just really wasn't a lot in the peer-reviewed literature about how trenbolone and a few of these other synthetic growth promoters behave in the environment. And in our paper, we talk about how widely used trenbolone is. I mean, it's given to the vast majority of beef cattle that are raised in the U.S., estimates in excess of 90%. So we're talking about tens of millions of animals. And so we really felt compelled that there is an obvious route of entry of these compounds into the environment. And then if you looked in the literature to figure out what all that meant, there really wasn't anything there, particularly for some of these sunlight-specific processes that we've studied and focused on. So it was just a big void that we felt had to be addressed. But it does speak to the challenge, you know, the other part of your question. There are so many that I think we need to be trying to come up with other ways that might be better to assess the real risks associated with the sort of vast mixtures of these micropollutants that might be out there.
Well, and you have found that these substances are in our water. You've found that these substances are not breaking down in the way that we thought that they were breaking down, so they're persisting in our water supply. What new questions for you does that raise? What is your next line of inquiry?
Yeah, I think we would argue that we know a lot less about what's truly out there in the environment with regard to trenbolone and its metabolites than we think we do. I think there's a large degree of uncertainty in all the occurrence data that people have reported. So if you asked me for a best guess estimate of how much might be encountered in ag-impacted water, I would say, you know, to be determined. I think we have to go out and do a lot of field analysis in light of our results to better analyze for these compounds, because we found some behavior. It was, you know, the whole process was sensitive to a few system conditions that could really lead to a large degree of uncertainty with current state of the art for analyzing for these types of compounds in the environment. And so that would be one thing. And I think the second is Ed and I really hope a message that will come from this is the need to revisit how we would do risk assessment and regulations of these types of contaminants. I talked a bit early on about how we tend to just think that removal, if we see a compound go away, we tend to feel like the risk is reduced. And I think we need to start thinking about decay not necessarily being equatable to the removal of all the risk that might be encountered by some of these aquatic pollutants.
So are you finding that there is interest from the Food and Drug Administration? Are you getting heard where you want to be heard?
We haven't heard anything from the FDA yet. I mean, I will say the work's only been out there for a couple of days. Our colleagues in the field of environmental engineering and chemistry have been incredibly supportive, and the work's been well received at our professional meetings where we present it. But I think we are interested to see what sort of happens next in the broader context. I think some of the news stories that have accompanied our report have had comments from Merck, which is one of the manufacturers of trenbolone. I think it's still, we'll see what happens in the next few months as to what the full response might be.
What does this mean to me, somebody who lives next to the Iowa River, and now I know that these substances are in the water there? What do I do with this information?
Well, I think a question we often get that we really want to be upfront about is, there really is very, it's very unlikely there's a human health risk associated with what we're seeing. The levels that are being detected in the environment, even some of the residues that can be encountered in meat, are really at quite low levels, that there's really no evidence that levels we might get exposed to as humans would be a real risk to us, because, you know, we're fairly large organisms with efficient livers that can help us sort of process the chemicals we get exposed to. So probably most relevant is just the health of the ecosystems around us, is that our ecosystems and the aquatic organisms that are present in them are likely struggling far more than we currently realize. And I think we need to be, as a society, more appreciative of the value of having a healthy ecosystem, as there's a lot that it does for us behind the scenes that we can take for granted. I think a bigger message for Iowans is really it's another story about balancing sustainable agriculture. You know, we note in our paper that growth promoters used in the cattle industry have tremendous benefits. They can reduce greenhouse gas emissions and nutrient loads, because if you're getting bigger, more efficient animals, you don't need as many, and you don't need to input as many resources. I think all we're hoping for is that our work can maybe motivate a more sustainable approach to developing growth promoters. And in many ways, that balance between trying to find sustainable agriculture is no different than a lot of the arguments we have here in Iowa over nutrient management. Finding some way to not really decrease the productivity of the farmers in Iowa, but finding a way to make sure that they're being as efficient as they can be without compromising the health of the environment.
I also hear you saying that there is a lot more stuff in our water than we have any idea about.
Yeah, I think we've as scientists have been really good at developing state-of-the-art analytical instrumentation that really allows us to see essentially needles in a haystack of needles. We've gotten really good at looking at trace compounds, and I think if you know, you can basically find what you look for. If we're interested in human pharmaceuticals or agrochemicals, we can usually find them at some level in our waters. The real question is what it all means and what the risks are. I think current convention is that the levels are sufficiently low that there's really not a concern to humans per se, and that the real focus should be on the risk to our ecosystems. That said, I think more research is needed to think about these diverse mixtures that we might get exposed to and what risks might be there, from the sort of constant subchronic exposure to far more diverse mixtures of chemicals than we probably expect and our body was really ever designed to get exposed to.
How long do you think it'll be before we have a complete understanding of what's out there?
That's a great question. I know people are working quite hard. I really think Ed and I are quite big fans of bioassays, this new type of analytical device that, rather than looking for specific compounds, you actually just try to look at the net effect of an exposure. So say you wanted to know how androgenic or estrogenic a water sample was. People are developing assays that can tell us that. So I think we're getting closer to being able to do something along that line. We even cite a study in our paper about some great work out of the Mid-Atlantic region that was looking at androgenicity in our nation's surface waters and found that, you know, 35% of the samples they looked at had an elevated androgenic response. But when you look for specific compounds that might be responsible, you don't necessarily see the causative agents.
Well, David, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
David Swartney is Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Today at noon, it's River to River, and host Ben Kiefer's here with me.
Hi, what's Charity. Very quickly, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the presidential historian, on the program today to talk about the 1912 fight for the GOP nomination. And live, Iowa State University President Stephen Leith talking about ISU's record enrollment and answering listener questions at noon, Charity.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you, Ben. And coming up tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, a conversation with Bill McAnally, our home improvement expert. This is Talk of Iowa.